Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It's summer, of course, which means Massachusetts farmer markets are in full swing.
And I am loving the taste of those fresh tomatoes.
And what's not to love? What about that fresh corn? And as many so-called locavores will tell you, eating that locally grown produce may bring you multiple benefits beyond the great taste.
Food writer Michael Pollan is the man many consider the nation's leading locavore. He's author of a number of books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma, in which he asks people to rethink what they're having for dinner and why.
Here's his take on why local is laudable.
The average item of food in America has traveled 1,500 miles from the farm to your plate. It's burned up an incredible amount of fossil fuel just to get there. If you're eating lettuce, say, in New York that's been grown in California, one of those bags of pre-washed mixed lettuce, it takes 56 calories of fossil fuel energy to deliver 1 calorie of food energy to your plate.
So, there's one line of thinking you've probably already heard. What about this one?
Okay, because it would result in a less diversified, more expensive, and less safe diet, locavorism can only deliver the world of yesterday. Locavorism, far from healing what ails us, is a recipe for widespread human misery and ecological disaster.
That's not Anthony. That's a quote from a new book called The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. It's a new book from Pierre Desrochers and Hiroko Shimizu. It's a no-holds-barred attack on locavorism. It's also a defense of agribusiness and a provocative new look at why eating local may never work in our world, which now has 7 billion people, the majority of whom live in cities. Pierre Desrochers is a professor of geography at the University of Toronto, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So your book is absolutely chock full of argument after argument against eating locally grown food. I'd like to spend a couple minutes sort of going through them one by one. What about that first argument that you heard from the tape we played of Michael Pollan, saying that, quite frankly, it's just environmentally better to eat local food?
Well, he's wrong. I mean, the two numbers that he quoted there have been challenged by a number of people. I mean, I won't get into the details, but when he says that we spend, for example, 56 calories fossil fuel to eat 1 calorie, well, what he doesn't say is that if we grew the stuff in New York State, we would actually, or in Boston where you are, we would actually use roughly the same amount of calories and typically more. The problem is that overall, people might fixate on transportation, but it really is a minuscule amount of the energy required to grow, process, and deliver food. So there have been some back-of-the-calculation envelopes in the United States which tell you that for the American food system, roughly 4% of the energy used is used for long-distance transportation and 83% for production. I mean,
I want to be sure that we understand all the numbers that, that you're presenting correctly.
It takes 20 times more energy to grow the food than to ship it over long distances. And so what happens is that when you cut on the transportation, you typically have to grow food in less ideal conditions than where it was grown in the first place before it was shipped over long distances. So a typical case, for example, would be, I'll stick to Europe here if you bear with me, growing tomatoes in Spain by the Mediterranean in greenhouses but that are non-heated is typically very efficient. You want to grow them in a cold and gray place like England, well, you obviously need a lot of electricity and natural gas to heat up the greenhouse. So the amount of energy that you spend on, let's say, trucking a tomato from southern Spain to northern Europe is a tiny fraction of the amount of natural gas that you need to heat the greenhouse at a more northern latitude. And you have the same problem across the United States. What can I say? Some places like Florida and Texas have heat in abundance. Upstate New York and New England, where you're located, aren't so great. If you're going to have a decent amount of local produce, apart from a few weeks each year when they're in season, you need to have heated greenhouses.
Well, I presume, though, that the sort of purest locavores among us who are listening right now are thinking, Well, we don't advocate growing oranges in New England. That basically true local food eating is eating that which is native to your backyard and also in season. So wouldn't that eradicate the concern of the high energy intensity production to grow oranges in New England?
Well, then, because you've got to remember, okay, let's look at apples, for example. A lot of them come right from upstate New York than in New England, but bear with me here. If you pick an apple in September or October, which are the typical time of the year that you pick an apple in New England, and you want to eat it in March or April, well, obviously, you need to keep it in cold storage for something like 6 months. There's a huge energy component associated with that. But if you import in March or April, say, an apple from Chile or New Zealand, what happens is that in the southern hemisphere, their seasons are inverted. So their summer is our winter and vice versa. They pick their apples in March or April. You put them on a container ship, which is by far the most energy efficient transportation mean ever devised by human brains. It costs about 1 cent to deliver an apple from New Zealand to North America. That's how efficient a container ship is. And then the apple ends up on your supermarket shelves, let's say 3 weeks after it was picked up in the southern hemisphere. So in that case, not only is the apple fresher, it is also typically tastier, and you've had less losses due to spoilage than if you had kept it for 6 months.
So you said it's typically tastier, but I think that,
a lot of progress. I mean, it's been changed a little bit, but I mean, an apple for a Granny Smith is a Granny Smith. A Fuji apple is a Fuji apple. It doesn't matter if you grow it locally or in New Zealand. I mean, production techniques are fairly similar now and products are relatively homogenized.
Well, the reason why I wanted to ask you about that point is because it's also one of the major sort of counter arguments you make in the book, that many advocates of local food say it tastes better when it's grown by your local farmer because it's not, this is not produce that's perhaps bred for surviving long transport. It comes to you when it's just ripe off the vine. But you say that you don't think that that's true.
No, this is not what we're saying. I mean, the problem, I'll give you a personal example. I live near the Niagara Peninsula. So here we grow peaches that are in season in the late summer, which are very good and obviously tastier than peaches that I've traveled elsewhere. The problem that I have is that at my local farmer's market, they insist on selling me a huge bucket. They don't sell small quantities. And the peaches are typically gone after 3 days. I mean, unless we can them or we try to do something with them right away, we will lose them very quickly. So yes, I mean, they're good in season for a few days, but there's a reason why the varieties of peaches that we consume were developed. And we're not arguing that local food in season will not be tastier. I mean, if you get a good quality-price ratio, well, obviously, good quality food has to be grown somewhere. We don't have a problem with that. The problem is that local food activists want to go beyond what is reasonable. And they will say, well, we're not advocating for people to, produce cocoa or oranges in New England. But if you insist on producing, let's say, local tomatoes in greenhouses, well, we obviously have a problem with that because it just doesn't make sense from an economic and environmental perspective.
Pierre Desrochers, I wonder if we could take a step back because the big point that you make in the book, I mean, there's a huge amount of discussion to be had about all the sort of smaller counter arguments that you make, all of which are very provocative and fascinating. Mm-hmm. But I do want to get to kind of what's underlying your argument here, that basically you say that we are living in a world now that's urban, quite frankly. I mean, more than 50% of human beings on the planet live in cities.
And it's only the beginning.
That by 2030, it's supposed to be an even larger percentage.
Yes.
But that it's in cities where you get certain efficiencies and economies of scale that allow human beings to basically lift themselves out of poverty. Right. And so you're saying in the book that you see the push to eat local food as antithetical to the possibility of prosperity in cities. Now, why is that?
So, basically what we argue in the book is that you never had any significant economic development and poverty reduction without urban growth. I mean, whether you're talking about ancient Greece, ancient China, modern-day China or something, people move to cities because living in cities close to each other, relying on multiple suppliers, being close to other creative people, using an airport just makes us more productive. And we quote in the book Plato, which I think many people will agree is kind of a well-known source, in the Republic, where over 2,000 years ago, a bunch of Greek philosophers are gathered together and discussing, well, obviously we need to live in cities. This is where civilization is. Where should we put our ideal city? And the philosophers quickly realize, well, they cannot put it anywhere in Greece that would not depend on imported food. And it's been the case for over 2,000 years. And so the main point that we make in the book is that, again, you cannot have significant poverty reduction without urbanization. Subsistence farming, which is essentially what local food eventually lead you to if you're consistent, is a poverty trap. You want to escape poverty, you need cities. And for thousands of years, we have been unable as a species to have cities without the long-distance trade in foodstuff.
Hmm. I do wonder, though, I can see where your line of thinking sort of emerges and takes us to, but it also sounds as if, you know, the nightmarish vision of the future that you have under a world ruled by locavores would really require vast numbers of people to eat locally. And I can't really identify, even in the most affluent, nostalgia-tinged neighborhoods of the United States, a neighborhood that's fully converted to local eating. So it sounds like almost as if you've set up a straw man, that there's going to be no city that says, we're going to do it all local.
No, but that's the thing. Then you've got to ask, well, why do we have a local food movement there if people don't take it seriously? I mean, basically what we argue in the book is that, well, local food activists tell us, well, local food is not so bad. We're not asking you to drink a bucket of arsenic, but just a few glasses of it. And so what we try to do deliberately is push the envelope to say, well, this is what would happen if this logic was pursued through its logical conclusion. But a lesser amount of a bad thing does not make it a good thing, which is essentially the real message of the book. But in order to illustrate that a lesser amount of a bad thing does not make it a good thing, we sort of illustrate how life was like when most food was local, or what life would be like if all food was local. So essentially, we want people to understand why pushing the envelope on this is bad, and why not pushing it as far ahead as some activists or some purists would have you to, is still not a good thing.
Hmm. Well, I am speaking with Pierre Desrochers. He is co-author of the new book, The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. So listeners, what do you make of it? Are you one of those, quote-unquote, locavores who goes out of your way to buy perhaps more expensive, harder-to-find food because it's grown here in New England? Or do you hear what Pierre Desrochers has to say and think to yourself, maybe there's a reason why we have a global food market, that there are efficiencies and economies of scale and maybe even safety factors built in to having our garlic come from China and our apples come from New Zealand? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment online, and I hope you do, at radioboston.org or on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Radio Boston. Professor Desrochers, if you could stand by for just a moment, we actually have a couple of the people who maybe might have a slightly different perspective than you to join us in this conversation. And the first one is John Gerber. He's a professor of sustainable food and farming at UMass Amherst. He joins us today from the studios of New England Public Radio. Professor Gerber, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me today.
So you've been listening to our discussion with Professor Pierre Desrochers. I wonder what your first reaction is to his claim that, or his idea that eating local is actually, it works against the possibilities of cities being a source of sort of a place where people can lift themselves out of poverty.
I agree. Taken to the extreme, that would be the case. But most small farms, most local farms are found close to cities currently where the people are. And so if you look at a map of the U.S., you find small local farms around urban areas in New York to Washington corridor, a couple of cities on the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, and around Chicago. We would like to see more of that, I think, because there seems to be consumer demand, but I'm not sure it's inconsistent with urbanism.
You don't think it's inconsistent with urbanism?
Unless it's taken to the extreme for the point of an argument, that's fine, but the reality of the situation is most small farms are found near urban areas where people are.
Hmm. And what do you make of his notion that basically there are major steps forward that we've taken when agriculture went global? Like, it's just an overall more efficient process from an environmental perspective. That's what Pierre Desrochers says.
Well, from an economic perspective, it's totally more efficient. We've had a cheap food policy in America, in the U.S. anyway, at least since the Eisenhower administration. It's been very, very successful, creating cheap food, lots of it, convenient as long as you have access to a supermarket. It's created huge profits from major corporate investors, and it's created huge, very efficient, economically efficient farms that have put small farms out of business. And if that's our intent, we have won. About 99% of the American food product, or agriculture, is sold through this global food system, this global corporate food system. And there is no battle any longer because they have won. I suggest that a successful food system does more than provide lots of food inexpensively into urban areas, but we can argue that.
Well, actually, so what would that more be?
Well, for me, I go back to the United Nations report that suggests that we need to provide adequate quantities of high-quality food, and quality is an issue, to all people, which we have not done effectively at a reasonable price through this global corporate-managed food system. I think we need to minimize our dependency on unstable sources of supply, and anything that we have to depend on foreign countries is an unstable source of supply in this day and age. And, of course, long supply chains make us vulnerable. So perhaps we need to hedge our bets a little bit and provide a little local product in the case of disruption. We have had disruptions in the past. We have about a three-day supply of food on the shelves in Boston, and I think we could perhaps provide a little resilience to the system if we had a little bit more local food. And third, the UN suggests that we need to not jeopardize future generations. And our current food system is so totally reliant on the assumption that inexpensive fossil fuels will be available forever that I think we have jeopardized future generations. And so we've done a great job producing food through this industrial system, and I think we can do better.
Now, Pierre Desrochers, I know that you probably have some very impassioned counterargument to what you just heard from Professor John Gerber, but let's take it step by step. Food security, because, for example, as Professor Gerber said, you know, there's this sense that with long supply chains and us, and I'll just say us in terms of Americans, for
example. How can you depend on those Canadians, right? Canadian
or here, political instability in other parts of the world. But for example, last time that the Eastern Seaboard got hit by a hurricane and or tropical storm, even just that was enough to interrupt supply chains for food coming up from the southern United States long enough that at my local supermarket, not far from the studios here at WBUR, the shelves were empty for a day or two because of what John Gerber was saying about three-day supplies. So it seems like we're already insecure.
Yeah, but think of it this way. What if, for example, like my wife, you're Japanese and you live in a part of Japan which is completely reliant on local food and you're hit by a tsunami and you have no infrastructure to deliver food from any other place? I mean, historically, this was the worst thing that could happen to you. You know, a flood, a drought, whatever. Local food systems were by far the least resilient because two bad harvests in a row and you would have a famine and you were not able to access the surplus food produced elsewhere. Now, what I would argue you hear from the try to put yourself in the shoes of a foreigner. I kind of understand this is difficult, but think
it's
of it.
It's maybe not as hard as you think. We're quite open-minded here. Give us some credit.
Farmer, and you produce all this food, way too much for the Canadian market, and somehow will you decide, oh no, I'm not going to sell to those pesky Americans because I want them to suffer. Well, no. I mean, local producers, and I'm again speaking as a Canadian here, are dying to sell to the U.S. What you don't want is relying on one type of supplier or specifically one regional supplier. You want to buy wheat today, you can buy it from Canadian, Argentinians, Eastern Europeans, Australians. Plenty of many regions in the world produce wheat. A place like Hong Kong does not go hungry. A place like Singapore does not go hungry. They're very wealthy city-states. That, well, I mean, it's less true for Hong Kong today, but bear with me, that rely entirely, 100% on food from the outside. They never go hungry. They never lack anything. And if nothing else, they pay less for their food and they have a better supply than other parts of the world that are more protectionist that will try to keep inefficient local producers in business.
And in fact, I mean, there's a lot of economic trade theory that says that by virtue of them not having to grow their own food, they can put their human and social capital into making, you know, other things like televisions and technology.
Exactly.
Well, let me turn that back to you, John Gerber, because I remember my parents come from India, and my father grew up incredibly poor. And I remember him telling me stories that when he was a child, he can recall watching his father, my grandfather, literally count the individual grains of rice that my family had left to eat. This is in the 1940s and 50s in India. And that was the state of, you know, a country that wanted to rely very heavily on local production and was rather protectionist. Now, India has actually totally turned the corner when it comes to agriculture since then. But I guess I'm bringing that up as a personal example of the argument that it is the globalized food industry that we have that, as you mentioned, has allowed poverty or like food insecurity to be eradicated for millions and millions of other people outside the United States, billions even.
Right. Wouldn't it be a travesty if we lost that? I'm not proposing that. I'm not proposing to replace a global food system with a local food system. I'm proposing a little bit of balance. A USDA ERS report suggested about 1% of the direct of the agricultural sales in America are direct to consumer food marketing. 1%. So I'm not sure that an argument that if we eliminate that 1% would be that much better. I think we could see a little bit more local food without jeopardizing creating ecological disasters and financial crises that that have been proposed here.
Mm. Do you see any? Do you share any concern that Pierre Desrochers has that the push to get people or cities or localities to buy more local food, you know, is actually working its way into policy? That, for example, activists are asking, you know, cities to source more of their own food in public schools, for example, locally, and therefore it's actually costing them more.
Well, one would hope so. We haven't been terribly effective at influencing public policy, but I think that would be a good thing.
Hmm. Well, we are talking about a new book called The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. It is by Pierre Desrochers. He's a professor of geography at the University of Toronto. I am also joined by John Gerber. He's a professor of sustainable food and farming at UMass Amherst. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Definitely wondering what you think, listeners. Do you buy your food locally? Should we buy more food locally? Or, as Pierre Desrochers says, do you think it's actually antithetical to what it takes to make a city run as efficiently as possible? Let's take a quick call here from Nancy, who's calling from Cohasset. You're on the air, Nancy.
Thank you for taking my call. To begin with, I think this is something of a warring philosophy. I think both are attainable and sustainable and comfortable. I have a wonderful farm market here. In season, I buy all of my vegetables there. I also recognize that when I would like to have asparagus with my broiled salmon, I will probably in the wintertime get it from Chile. I understand that there are huge economies and perhaps political philosophies involved here. I'm speaking as a good cook, a housewife, and someone who wants to serve my family the best produce that's on the market at the time, and we like it fresh. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Nancy, thank you so much for your call. Pierre Desrochers, it seems as if Nancy's very representative of, I'll go out on a limb here, the majority of people who basically say, I am fortunate enough to live in a place and have enough money that I can have the best of both worlds, so why not?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, one thing that is often missing in the discussion from a northern, let's say, perspective is that this thing works both ways. So at certain times of the year, if you go to New Zealand, you will find kiwis that were grown in Italy. And because, again, the seasons are inverted, what people tend to forget is what the life was for local farmers when most of their market was local. So today you hear people say, well, I can buy sometimes some items cheaper at the local farmers market. Well, what happens typically is that local farmers tend to specialize in the same thing, and they all dump their produce at the same time at the local farmers market. They don't get a very good price for it. If they're able to export it beyond their local food shed, to speak like local food activists, they can typically get a better price for that. And it seems to me local food activists are missing this obvious point, which is that if you care about the financial security of farmers in the long run, allowing them the opportunity to sell beyond their local area is really what will keep them in business.
But hasn't the horse already left the barn on that? Because the problem is that small farmers can't compete with the gigantic global agribusiness, can they not? I mean, they just can't move things the way that...
No, problem. Those that will compete, the small farms near cities that we were talking about before, will typically find niche products that command premium prices, mm-hmm. which is fine if people are willing to pay for that. But don't tell me that local food will actually help feed a large number of people at an affordable price. And honestly, this is still my priority at this point. I don't care what upper middle class consumers do with their money. They want to buy, Brandywine tomatoes or something like that that is produced locally, fine. They can afford to pay three times the price of a regular tomato at the local supermarket. But that's what it will remain, a niche for upper-middle-class consumers.
Well, hold that thought, because I do want to introduce briefly one more guest who may have a response or a different take from what you're saying about that. It's Glenn Lloyd. He is the CEO of City Fresh Foods and founder of City Growers. They produce food from Boston farms and sell it to restaurants and markets across the city. And they also provide meals for schools and seniors. Glenn Lloyd, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you are, I suppose we could call you, you're a businessman and local farmer right here in Boston. What's your response to Pierre Desrochers's point that the problem isn't so much, you know, upper middle class people who can afford to shop locally, but that it's not a viable way forward for the less affluent, for the poor?
Well, I think there's a fundamental issue with, you know, the existing, he mentions the existing system of the conventional system that we kind of rely on currently. And I guess the one benefit is it allows for more affordable products. But one thing that we've learned being in the food service business and trying to grow a higher quality food is no one calorie coming out of the, you know, the ground is the same. And what you find is you find a lot of product that is, you know, of lower quality and of lower health measures. And that actually has a negative effect in the communities where you're talking about, you know, the effect on poverty. So I think, to kind of agree with the Professor Gerber, it really is about balancing. How do we get more fresher, local produced product into the system, where the conventional system has been subsidized, and is more advantageous for the larger farms and the larger producer to move their product into the system, which he says, you know, they've clearly won. So really, it's really balancing it back so we can get more local producers and regional producers to bring their product. And the benefits are, you know, there's a whole list of benefits from higher quality calories to a fresher product to local employment and even greening the cities. We have land that's been idle for decades. It will continue to be idle and that's a whole other different show.
Now, have you been able to prove that it is possible to get that local product to people who may conventionally not be able to afford it at its current prices?
Well, it is challenging to do both, to try to create local production, you know, for the farmer so they can, you know, make a decent wage, and to supply that type of product to, I guess, the folks who typically don't have access. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our product is coming out and going to the higher-end markets, because that's what's going to support the smaller producers. But some of that product does flow into our kitchen, which actually gets produced and feeds the folks who have less access to the healthier stuff.
I'm sorry, Glenn Lloyd, to jump in on you here, but we're fast running down of time, and I do want to give Professor John Gerber a chance to have a final thought here. Professor Gerber, I mean, you've heard Pierre Desrochers, give his very impassioned counter-argument that he says local isn't good. Are you concerned that this is sort of an inevitable pushback in terms of the fact that eating local has kind of become more popular, more accepted over the past, you know, several years?
Well, I celebrate the pushback because it suggests something big is beginning to happen, and I would like to see more of it.
Mm. And final thought to you, Pierre Desrochers, you've definitely got people thinking.
Yeah. Well, the problem is not that we have too much globalization. The problem is that we don't have enough of it. So we should not pull back. We should move forward, get rid of all agricultural subsidies, open up world trade to agricultural products, and that way more food will be produced in the best location, lower prices, more variety, less environmental impact. More globalization is the way to go, not more localization.
Well, this has definitely been a bracing conversation that's got me thinking. Pierre Desrochers is the author of The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. Professor Desrochers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Glenn Lloyd, CEO of City Fresh Foods and founder of City Growers, much more to talk to you about in future episodes of Radio Boston. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And John Gerber, professor of sustainable food and farming at UMass Amherst. Pleasure to speak with you, Professor Gerber. Thank you for your time.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
And listeners, I didn't get to all of you. There were a lot of people who wanted to send us some comments. So do so online at radioboston.org. Stay with us, because there is much more coming up. Our political team takes a look at how the Massachusetts Senate race is addressing issues of poverty and the middle class. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.